For the week of May 23rd, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 55, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in Berkeley Square in central London, I'm Michael Giltz.
What are you doing in London?
My sister lives there. I always come here for a couple weeks before or after Cannes and go to theater and do some work and have some fun.
Can I have your life?
Sure. Can I have yours?
Okay, cool. Yeah. I don't know, though. I kind of like my life.
And I guess for you, Michael, Cannes was not fun, so you had to go to London to have fun.
Cannes was a lot of fun.
Well, and we will be talking about Cannes, and all of the winners will be wrapping up our Cannes coverage a little later, right after box office. We're also going to be talking about movie ticket prices and, of course, 3D, as well as how you'll be able to watch first-run movies as they enter the theater, or shortly after they enter the theater, but at home. We also have some interesting television news. Of course, we'll talk about the series finale of Lost, or at least its wonderful ratings. And we'll wind up with a little big deal or big whoop. And finally, some inside baseball, in which we'll talk about the Weinsteins and Miramax. But as always, we start off with box office, and we'll turn it over to Michael to tell us how all the films fared over the weekend.
Well, while we were in Cannes seeing films about yak herders in the mountains of Tibet, nobody apparently much was going to see Shrek Forever After. It was number one at the box office with a very disappointing $71.2 million. A lot of reasons for that, but we'll get to that later. And number two was Iron Man 2, falling kind of hard in its third weekend, making $26 million for $251 million total in the U.S., $509 million worldwide. Robin Hood was at number three with $18 million. It's at $66 million total. Worldwide, it has $191 million. That was way off of what people were hoping or expecting for that film. Letters to Juliet was polling very well at number four with $9 million. That grossed $27 million. Just Right, the Queen Latifah film, is fading pretty quick. It's at $14 million total. And the biggest flop of the even bigger than Shrek is probably MacGruber, a spoof of MacGyver of all things, about 20 years too late. It opened to $4.1 million. Its average per screen was $1,607. It is the 10th film in a row to try to be a spinoff from a Saturday Night Live skit and to fail disastrously. It hasn't worked since Wayne's World. They should just stop.
And even worse, it came from Universal, which has not had much luck at the box office recently.
Yes, and then Date Night is still chugging along. A Nightmare on Elm Street is fading fast. How to Train Your Dragon is still drawing in some people. And at number 10 was Kites. Karen, did you go to see anything this weekend? We, of course, were seeing art films. We were seeing films about men recalling their past lives and with monkey ghosts in it. What were you seeing?
You know, I didn't go and see anything, but you know, I watched on TV on American Movie Classics of all stations, Troy, which is that decidedly not a classic movie with Brad Pitt. Did you guys ever see this when it was in the theaters?
Yes, I did. I actually saw the premiere.
It's a terrible movie and yet like just wickedly entertaining. Like I'm embarrassed that I'm entertained by it, but it's awful, but it's good.
American Movie Classics really sort of just lost their meaning years ago. I mean, Turner Classic Movies is the only cable channel to watch old movies on. AMC is just a joke now.
Oh, totally. No question about it.
You know, it's commercials. They're showing current stuff. It's just, you know, they have no brand left. And I think even their original run series don't really help them that much. I mean, you might go there for Mad Men or Breaking Bad, which is the best show on TV right now, I think. But it doesn't add to their brand. It's just sort of it's sort of all by itself. It doesn't make you want to come back to AMC and see other stuff.
Well, speaking of things that have lost their meaning, I mean, look at Shrek. That franchise, I think, has pretty much played out its welcome. I thought it played out its welcome after the third film, and I think audiences are telling DreamWorks, enough is enough. They're not going to see this fourth film.
Well, the first three all made tons of money. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, it wasn't played out financially and creatively. I didn't even like the first one. But isn't this really about 3D? Isn't this really people saying, you know, people got spooked. The AMC said, oh, we're charging $20 per ticket. And said, oh, no, that's a mistake. We didn't really mean to do that. And I think audiences are just sick of, you know, every other movie that's a family franchise is in 3D. And they got to pay an extra $3 a ticket to take their kids. And when you go to these movies, you usually don't take just your kids. You take the neighbor's kids or somebody, you know, you've got three or four or five kids with you. And that $3 an extra per ticket starts to really add up.
Well, yeah, and that was one of our stories that we were going to talk about today, but we may as well bring it up now. And there was a good article in the Wall Street Journal by Lauren Shuker, who of course was one of our guests, our previous guests. She's been doing yeoman's work along with Ethan Smith over at the Wall Street Journal, covering a lot of different topics, including the Miramax Weinstein deal, movie ticket prices, and there was one other story. I believe the Best Buy going to straight into the home. Anyway, you're right. AMC raised their ticket prices on Thursday just before Shrek Forever After hit theaters to $20 in some theaters, not all. And it seems to be located, the problem seems to be located mostly around New York. The AMC Kips Bay, the Lowe's 34, the AMC Lowe's Lincoln Square, and the AMC Empire 42nd Street all had $20 tickets on sale for IMAX 3D. The exhibitor, the company AMC, came out and said, oops, that was a mistake. We didn't mean to raise ticket prices.
Yeah, right.
They said, unfortunately, a limited number of theaters posted incorrect pricing for Shrek Forever After, which we immediately corrected.
Yeah, but nobody's tired of 3D. It's like saying they're tired of sound or color. It's like if they use it fine, it's fine. You know, if they wear the glasses and it's a good movie, they're happy. But they're sick of high ticket prices. That extra $3 per ticket is just their way of jacking up ticket prices. It should be added value entertainment without charging you extra money for it. That's what people are sick of, high ticket prices. It's too much money, especially when you're taking your kids to the movie.
Well, they lowered their prices. The prices are back down to between $17 and $19.
That's not lowered. They're a premium. They cost more than any other movie you'll see at their stadium. That's insane.
Yeah, I agree.
It makes me not want to see 3D movies because they cost more. It's not worth it.
Well, Richard Greenfield, who's a media analyst for BTIG, kind of agrees with you. He says, we suspect AMC and other theater owners are concerned about consumer backlash over 3D pricing. Considering the state of the economy and increased consumer focus on price points, this quote-unquote hiccup over pricing could make it more difficult for AMC to raise prices over that $20 barrier in the future. And I would have to agree, that $20 barrier is a huge mental hurdle, at least right now. Maybe 10, 15 years in the future, it won't be. But to pay $20 for a movie when you could go buy a DVD, that's a huge hurdle.
But Sperling, what's the average ticket price in the U.S.? It's still like $7, $8, isn't it?
I believe it's $7.65 or $7.85, right, somewhere in there.
The average ticket price in the U.S., is that what you just said?
Yes, the average ticket price in the U.S. is $7.85, $7.65, yeah, somewhere in there.
I'd venture to say it was a little higher, but okay.
Well, think about it. You have to take into account it's an average. It's not...
Yeah. I still, yeah.
So.
Yeah, in the Heartland, you don't pay $12, $15 to see a movie.
Yeah, good point.
And then you've got matinees and you've got bargain price times and, you know, all that stuff. Plus kid
that
prices are
low. That sound you
lower.
Hear is people emailing us from the Heartland being like, what are you talking about?
Well, you know, a lot of the gross for Shrek Forever After, which opened on a record number of 3D screens, 2,373, 3D accounted for 61% of its business and included
that's
in
that. That's really low, isn't it?
No, that's, well, it's between 60 and 80 is usually average, so it's on the low end.
So that's at the bottom end.
Yes.
Wait, I didn't know that not seeing it in 3D was an option.
Yeah, absolutely. They don't have enough 3D screens, so seeing it in 2D on film is absolutely an option.
But you still feel stupid because it was made to be seen in 3D. So it's not like a movie like Clash of the Titans where it was made in 2D and, you know, if you don't want an extra pow, whatever. I mean, if it's made in color, I want to see it in color. But then they want to charge me extra for it. I just feel like a schmuck. So then you decide not to go see it at all, which is apparently what a lot of people did.
Personally, I don't care about seeing Shrek in 3D. And if I was bringing the kids to go see it, I don't care if they see it in 3D. All I care about is that I get to pay less money. Screw the 3D.
Yeah.
So I guess you're not going to see it on IMAX, where it played on 194 screens and accounted for 7% of the gross.
Well, let's face it. It's a cartoon. I'm not going to see it at all.
Well, you know, I think the 3D and IMAX ticket price premiums added to around $13 million to Shrek Forever After's gross, which means that not a lot of people actually went and saw it, because really it only made, when you take that into account, it really only made about $58 million.
Karen, would you pay $20 or $30 to see Shrek 3D in your home with a bunch of kids around?
I'm okay. First of all, you lost me at cartoon and you lost me at kids. No, no, flat out
well,
no.
Would you do it for any movie? Would you say, all right, it's still in theaters, but I'll pay $30 so we can all gather around and see it all at once at home?
Right now, I can't think of a movie that is worth that.
Say the next Harry Potter film, if you've got kids.
Okay, I hate Harry Potter, and I don't have kids. So try again.
What about Twilight? What about Sex and the City 2?
No, you know, you're naming movies that I would go see probably, but yeah, nothing, none of those is worth $30 to me.
Yeah, but Sex in the City 2, you and all your friends can sit around and watch it without having to go to the theater and pay popcorn and all pay, you'd pay $50, $60, $70
Yeah, but what
together.
am I going to do? Be a cheapskate and make my friends pay me back?
No, you're
How's
having a
that going to work?
party.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. Or married couples with kids who can't go out. What you're referring to, Michael, is actually a story that we've also highlighted for this week, which plays off of a topic and a subject that we've discussed previously on Showbiz Sandbox, which I think it was last week or the week before. The FCC approved or is going to allow, in a restricted sense, the use of selective output control, or SOCs.
You're getting way too technical. It's been approved, and now Hollywood is ready to start making movies available in your home 30 days after it debuts in the theater.
Right. I
And you're
mean,
going to pay $20 to $30 a pop to see a new movie like Shrek Forever After or Sex and City 2 in your home 3 or 4 weeks after it debuts in the theater.
correct. Yeah. And this was kind of undoable before because you'd be able to stream it through your TiVo and capture it on a DVD
It
and.
was doable. They do pay-per-view all the time. They didn't need this new technical change, but that's a different issue.
Of course, what's interesting is that, again, a Wall Street Journal article from Lauren Shuker and Ethan Smith, Hollywood is eyeing a shortcut to TV. The Time Warner Cable Company, which is my cable company, made the first formal pitch to the Hollywood studios for what is known as home theater on demand. And the cable company presented a variety of scenarios, but the main one, which has received early support from some studio executives, would allow consumers to watch a movie at home, just as you mentioned, Michael, 30 days after its theatrical release, far earlier than the usual 4 months, for roughly $20 to $30 a pop. Well, if they're charging $20 at the box office, then why would I go to the movie theater? They're going to have to make it a little bit more than $30.
You've got it backwards, you mean?
Yeah,
What do you
less
mean?
than $30.
Right, because 10 people can go for that. 5 people can watch it for $20 or $30.
Right, and I'm saying they need to make the home theater on demand more than $30.
More expensive? Why? Most
Why?
people pay $7 for a ticket.
I see where you're going with that.
That's
I see.
Come at it from a
yeah, that's
consumer's
IMAX
point of view.
3D spectacular. But anyway.
No, I see where you're going with that. That, you know, if you're going to a movie theater, which has to have projectors and a big screen and seating and comfortable seats, and, you know, then it should cost more money than having to you know, see it at home
Yeah.
where the studio doesn't have to pay for anything or the movie theater doesn't have to pay for anything.
But why aren't theater distributors in up in a roar over this?
Okay, when you say theater distributors, you mean movie theater owners, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, they are in an uproar about this. So without a doubt, make no mistake, this will happen. And the business models have to change for theater owners and for theater and movie distributors. But how that changes and what change will work, who knows? And I think the Wall Street Journal kind of mentioned that, well, maybe studios will start with a little test on a smaller movie and see how that works. And I have to say that, you know, I can't always get to the theater. With 2 kids, you know what? Sometimes, yeah, I would pay the $20, $25 to see a film at home.
Like Furry Vengeance?
No, I wouldn't pay to see that in the theater or at home or on DVD.
See, I think that looks funny. I'd totally see that on DVD.
But aren't they screwing themselves? This seems really, I'm all for smart windows and all that, but this seems to really undermine everything. It undermines DVD, it undermines the theaters, it undermines everything. I
Well,
mean,
yeah.
why would you ever want to do this with a big blockbuster? I can see it makes sense with indie films or art films where they're not going to play in every city, or like Carlos, a film we saw at Cannes that's going to be available. They're going to show it on TV, and then they're going to show it in the theater and put it on demand the same day. That makes perfect sense to me because it's never going to play in a, 2,000 screens. But a big summer blockbuster, why would you ever want to put it in homes 3 weeks after it's debuted in a theater?
I would have to agree with that, and I would think that this would not be a plan for Iron Man 2 because.
Wait, I see. To me, that's. I feel exactly the opposite. I feel like those are the only movies that are worth doing it. Why do you feel differently?
You screw your box office. You can get people to pay to watch it at home down the road anyway. Why screw the pooch of the $10 billion industry that you have set up, showing movies
Because
in
you've got a
theaters?
lot of young parents who can't afford. I'm just never mind. I'm like, who can't afford the babysitter, and yet they're going to pay all this money for a movie.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I still think that my argument sort of holds. I mean, you've got people who don't want to leave the you've got the agoraphobics. You've got the people who have young kids. You've got the people like me who don't want to deal with the crowds on an opening weekend for a movie like that. I think you'd be surprised the amount of that would actually do quite well.
No, people would do it and people would pay for it, but then you just undermine the theatrical business that you have built up over 100 years.
Essentially what you're saying, Michael, is you'd ruin the recurring revenue of being able to charge a customer at the movie theater and then charge them for the DVD or charge them for video on demand later. So you're basically selling the same product to the same customer twice, but in this case, you're kind of cutting off one of those sales.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look,
I bet you that wouldn't happen.
Well, only time will tell. The reality is this is going to happen because there is money there and Hollywood is looking to replace that DVD revenue, which has declined. And, you know, I would say just get ready for it. Best Buy, we have another story here, again from the Wall Street Journal, that they're going to start selling on-demand access to movies and TV shows through some Blu-ray players and high-definition TVs. Initially, they will be LG TVs and Blu-ray players, and eventually they will move on to other manufacturers. But I think they bought Cinema Now. They're going to be offering this through Cinema Now. So they're even getting into the game.
Does anybody care that Best Buy is doing this? I mean, they have no access to product, so I mean, why would they be a middleman? Well, they don't seem like a very natural middleman to me.
Yeah, well, I think they're trying to save their business because a large part of their business was not only selling electronics equipment, but also selling DVDs and CDs, and they see that going away, and they are correct in assuming that it will go away.
But DVDs are a $15 billion industry, not going anywhere in the next 5 to 10 years. But why would I want to do my thing through Best Buy instead of Time Warner or something like that?
Well, if you're a Hollywood studio, you want as many distribution channels as you can possibly get. So what if Best Buy wants to sell it and Netflix wants to rent it?
No, I mean, as a consumer, it just seems, why would I even ever consider signing up for Best Buy's deal?
Really only because of the electronics. This is just another way for them to move electronics. So... Yeah. If you happen to have an LG Blu-ray player, then you know what? Sure.
It strikes me of desperation.
Well, so does releasing movies to home theaters on demand 30 days after they hit theaters.
Right, and ruining the $25 billion combined industry of theatrical distribution and DVDs.
No, I don't think it's going to ruin it. I think it would only add to it.
Well... Just a few notes here since we've talked about these before. We were going to talk about Cannes first. A couple of notes. One, box office for this year is kind of flat. And we mentioned Richard Greenfield of BTIG, and he's basically an analyst. Earlier, he has a wonderful blog post called "Is the Novelty of 3D Wearing Thin as Ticket Prices Continue to Rise?" And this is an interesting little tidbit here. He says, despite IMAX 3D screens rising from 143... or 3.5% of screens, when Monsters vs. Aliens was released, to 194, or 4.5%, for Shrek Forever After, and a dramatically higher 3D IMAX ticket price, IMAX 3D box office, as a percentage of total box office, was only 7% for Shrek versus 9% for Monsters vs. Aliens. So really, I could have just skipped to that part, but I find it interesting. The IMAX percentage is actually dropping as screen counts rise. And that is directly related to ticket prices.
Yeah.
He also goes on to say that despite the significant increase in ticket prices year over year benefiting, I guess, 2010, and it's impacted three films, of course.
They're charging more money, but box office is flat.
Thank you.
That means attendance is down.
Yes. Yes, you're right. That was a better way of saying that. Thank you very much.
That's Michael, our resident recapper.
Did I ask for nutshelling? I don't think I asked for nutshelling. Speaking of nutshelling, we should probably talk about Cannes and wrap up our Cannes coverage.
In a week or two, nobody's going to care, but for 2 weeks, it was exciting.
Yes, that is true. And, and nobody will care because look at the films they selected to win. All of the front runners didn't win. The front runners picked by the public and the press.
No. Uncle Boonmi was probably the best reviewed film of competition alongside the Mike Lee film. So that was certainly a front runner.
Okay, so now this is a film, Uncle Boonmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives. That's the title of the film. And it's directed by Apichatpong Virs. I can't pronounce it. Michael, can you pronounce his name? He's a Thai director.
I liked your attempt, Sperling, personally.
Yeah, you keep trying.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think our listeners want to hear me try and pronounce this gentleman's name.
Call him Joe.
Yeah, I guess he likes...
You're going to start writing in saying that you're mocking him.
No, I'm not. No, I mean, he actually has told people, call me Joe, because he knows his name is hard to pronounce. But now, this was a movie that I had never seen any of his films before. And as the lights were dimming...
Oh, really?
No, never. I thought we talked about that. But as the lights are dimming in the Salle de Bussy, which is the theater it was shown in for the press, somebody turned to me and said, have you ever seen any of his films? And I said, no, I haven't. They said, be prepared for about 30% of the audience to leave. And literally, this was one of those films that just was very lyrical and looked beautiful and had almost no plot. But for him, this apparently, for this particular filmmaker, this is like Star Wars.
Yeah, it's about an old man who's dying of kidney, I think failing kidneys, and his sister and nephew come by to help take care of him, and then the ghosts of his wife and the ape-like son, who now looks like a member of Planet of the Apes, stop in as visions to help him recall his past lives and get ready for the next step in his adventure. Then he wanders out to a cave where he was apparently first born 10,000 years ago, and we have a cutaway to an era when he was either a princess, a commoner, or a catfish. And the princess is in love with the commoner, but then gets seduced by the catfish, who makes love to her as a catfish, and then turns her into another catfish, and they go off together, and then the movie ends.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that at this point in the festival, I was so tired that my eyes were kind of closing, because there's not a lot of dialogue, and there are weird things, like there'll be two people having a conversation, and then poof, all of a sudden there's like the ghost of the ex-wife, or the former wife just shows up as a ghost. The coolest thing in it was the red-eyed monkey ghosts, which, as one of our friends said, Michael, the second he saw that, he said, oh, this is right up Tim Burton's alley. And, of course, Tim Burton was the president of the jury.
Right. So, I mean, but to be clear, Apichapong Wirasithukul is a huge international film director. He only exists in the film festival world. Even in Thailand, his movies are not seen. People do not watch his movies in Thailand. From what I've heard, they barely know who he is.
Yeah, you know.
But I'm sure he was the front page of the papers having won. This is the first Thai film to win the Palme d'Or, of course, the top prize at Cannes. He's absolutely an auteur. If you look at the best of the decade list from the 2000s, two or three of his movies are on almost all of those lists, whether it's Film Comment, Cahiers du Cinema, IndieWire. His movies like Syndromes in a Century and Tropical Malady.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just a major auteur that cineasts and film critics love and that the regular audience never has and never will watch. But it was fun to see him triumph here at Cannes. I mean, it was the most critically acclaimed movie of the fest. He'd won the runner-up prize in the past for Tropical Malady. So he clearly was a director that's, beloved by filmmakers and critics. So there was a real roar of joy from the critics when he was named the top prize winner at the award ceremony on Sunday.
Well, you mentioned that he's kind of an auteur filmmaker. And, in talking to Terry Frémeau, the head of the festival, he said that, the pure auteur film no longer works in Cannes, nor does the big blockbuster spectacle like Indiana Jones or Robin Hood. So this is a pure auteur film that's kind of a slow-moving movie. And so here he said that, I guess, on Friday, and on Sunday, this film wins.
Karen, will you go see it?
No, I'm bored just hearing about it.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, so it was a massive critical favorite and a big winner. The run-up was a much more traditional film called Of Gods and Men from France about Cistercian monks who were slaughtered in Algeria. And then the third prize was a Chad film. Africa really has never produced great movies yet. I don't know why. They have great musicians, great playwrights, great novelists, great actors, but they have not produced great film work. And this perhaps is a step forward. It's called A Screaming Man, but it's not a good movie, trust me. And then some big stars won the acting awards. Javier Bardem tied for best actor with Elio Hermano, an Italian actor I really liked, and Juliette Binoche won for her film with Abbas Kiarostami. So it was a quiet festival. There were very few journalists here, very little business, no parties, not even a lot of billboards on the Croisette, but it was fun. And there were some great, great movies.
Did you say what Javier Bardem won for? Beautiful?
He won for Beautiful, a film by the director of Babel. and 21 Grams and Amores Perros.
Right. And
which still doesn't
I hate
have
the fact that they
yet,
misspell beautiful. They that won- really bothers me.
That was the whole point, that they did misspell beautiful.
Well, it's a thing that his daughter writes on a drawing that she does.
Oh.
Right. And she's
it's
trying
cute.
To. Yeah. And winning the Critics Week was Armadillo. Now, Michael, did you see that?
Yeah, I did. Armadillo is a Danish documentary about Danish soldiers spending 6 months in Afghanistan. You know, when I first saw it, it was very familiar. I'd seen plenty of other documentaries about Afghanistan and Iraq. But it was pretty good. It was pretty well made. But it made news back in homeland because it reopened military investigation into possible war crimes. It's the first documentary to win the Critics Week. So it was an interesting win overall. And it looked great. I have to say that it was a really good looking movie. And those filmmakers were right in the thick of it. They were in the middle of firefights. They clearly risked their lives to make the film. So I'm glad they won an award for it.
Well, a couple of other prizes. One went to Poetry by Li Shangdong, which was, I guess, best screenplay. And this was another favorite at the festival when it screened. Of course, it's the one film I decided not to wake up at 8:30 in the morning for, and it goes on to win best screenplay. And everybody was talking about it as a potential Palme d'Or winner. And let's see, who won the director award? Oh, yeah, how could I forget? Matthew Amalric for Entour, or the French title is Tournée. Now, this was the film we talked about last week, and Michael and I were not big fans of it, but we soon found out that every French journalist loved it.
The only fun part of it winning was Matthew getting to bring up all the new burlesque stars on stage with him, each one of which was in a costume more gaudy than the other. They had a grand time walking the red carpet, posing at the top of the stairs, sitting in the theater, tearing up, clambering on stage, waving to everybody. They would have done their whole routine if they'd been given a chance, but happily that didn't happen.
Well, now, before we kind of depart from Cannes, I mean, I've already departed, obviously, but before we depart from the subject of Cannes, do you think that there is any link to the fact that there was all this political turmoil in Thailand and a Thai film wins? Do you think that maybe it kind of...
Absolutely not.
No?
No, okay. He's won the runner-up prize. He has two or three films on every list of the best films of the decade. He's a major, major filmmaker that critics and cineasts and filmmakers love. And he was due to win the Palme d'Or. You know, he was poised to win it. He'd done everything. He'd had great success, got the runner-up prize. He was just right in there for the last 5 or 10 years. It was a matter of time, really, before he won.
Now, I left before the awards were announced, but what did people think of Juliette Binoche winning for Certified Copy? A lot of people felt like, well, she's on the poster, the official poster for this year's Cannes Film Festival. She probably won't win a Best Actress prize. I was kind of glad to see she won.
I thought she would. I mean, but she's, you know, she's worked with Godard and Abbas Kiarostami and, you know, and Hao Shaoshan. I mean, she's worked with so many top major directors and yet still is also a star. She's not, you know, some tiny little actress. She's a big star and she makes big movies and she works with, you know, really strong directors. She's the absolute, you know, poster child for a film festival like Cannes. So she's beloved there. The French call her La Binoche. You know, she's just a grand figure in cinema that keeps churning out great performances in really challenging, interesting films. So people were happy that she won.
And, of course, the grand prize winner, I liked it, Des Hommes et des Dieux.
Yeah, we already talked about this.
Yeah, I mean, did you like it?
I liked it okay. I'd like to see it again. I was a little tired. I wasn't wildly moved by it, but it was well made and there were a lot of good actors. It's about these monks who get slaughtered in Algeria in 1996. And my parish priest back in New York, every year he reads the letter that this monk wrote before he knew the soldiers were going to come at some point and kill them. They knew that. They could have left, and they chose not to stay with the villagers and the people that they were helping and working with in this small town in Algeria. And he wrote a letter almost to his attackers saying he loved them. And it's a really beautiful, moving letter. And my priest reads this every year at Mass on the anniversary of their slaughter. And I saw this movie and I didn't realize until the end, until they started to read the letter and voiceover, that this was that letter and that incident. And suddenly, I recognized the letter and what he was saying because I've heard it every year. So that was really interesting for me. And I was just a little tired. I'd like to see it again, but very well, you know, well-acted, well-made traditional film.
Yeah, another well-made traditional film was Outside the Law, also set in Algeria. And during that last day, there were all these rumors of violent protests and they were doing the whole airport thing on the way into the theater. You had to leave your water behind. It was, the gendarmes were out
in force.
Yeah. And so now, what was your favorite film of the festival or favorite films of the festival and least favorite?
My favorite was Another Year, the Mike Lee film, and the Chinese director Jia's movie called I Wish I Knew, Carlos, the 5.5-hour document film about Carlos the Jackal, Blue Valentine, which debuted at Sundance, starring Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. So Khan doesn't really get credit for it, but it's the first time I saw it. And Inside Job, the documentary about the meltdown of Wall Street. And my least favorite film was close to it was Tournée. That was ridiculous and outrage by Takashi Kitano with yet another dull Yakuza film. La Casa Muda was this stupid horror flick all done in one take. It was incredibly moronic. But perhaps the most exhausting film was Burnt by the Sun 2, The Exodus, which is 2.5 hours long. Nothing happened and it ended with the threat, end of part one. And nobody knew it was a cliffhanger and nothing would be resolved until we got to the end of the movie. So that was a little dispiriting.
Were there boos?
There was just, people were too exhausted to boo. They just...
Oh, brother. Well, I have to agree with you on Inside Job. Definitely a documentary that's important for this for the United States and important really for the world when you think about it. A great documentary by Charles Ferguson. I agree with you on Another Year. I'm really surprised that Mike Lee didn't win anything. He was the talk of this year's Cannes and walked away with nothing. I also like.
Well, he's won the Palme d'Or before, you know.
Yeah, and I like Tamara Drew, which was the comedy from Stephen Frears.
Oh.
I know you hated it.
That is one of the best films of the fest, surely.
Not one of the best films. I enjoyed it. I liked the Chinese film Chongqing Blues. Now, did you see Rubber?
No.
Basically, it was a horror film where the antagonist was a tire. So I'm trying to find somebody who saw that. Overall, it was kind of what? If you had to sum up your Cannes experience, how would you do it?
Typical. I saw 4 or 5 great movies that'll be on my best of the year list. It's what always happens. No matter how much people bemoan the movies, I always end up seeing 3 or 4 or 5 movies that are among the best of the year. And that's a good way to spend 10 days.
And I would agree with you. And we should probably move on before Karen falls asleep.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm awake.
You didn't watch the finale of Lost, did you, Karen?
Who, me? No, I didn't make a big production out of it or anything. Have you watched it yet?
I have not watched it, so please don't tell me anything. I'm actually...
Oh, come on! It's Pearly!
Oh, love of God.
I'm actually 12 episodes behind, although now I've watched 2 of them, so I'm only 10 episodes behind.
Oh, but then we're not getting a free pass on this one. Michael, what did you think?
I didn't watch it. I wouldn't watch it. I haven't watched it in 4 years. But I would say that Sperling's prediction of 113 million viewers was off by about 100 million viewers.
Hold on a second. Hold on. I'm just... carry the one. Add the two... Yeah, about 100 million viewers. Yeah,
yeah,
give
about 100 million viewers off. It grossed, it hit 13.5 million viewers, the best ratings in about 2 years. But, you know, this is the problem with a show with a long, complicated storyline. When you lose viewers, they never come back. Even it wasn't like The Fugitive where at the finale you could say, hey, he's going to finally catch the one-armed man. It was just a finale that would probably mean nothing to you if you hadn't been following the sideways alternate reality and the temple people and all the stuff that I kept reading about that just made me go, thank God I stopped watching that show. Oh, and I hear people are very split about the ending. Some of them think it cheated by not explaining the big question or the island, what it is. Others felt like it did what it could do and gave a satisfying finale. I can't sum it up in 3 words, but we can't do that because Sperling is listening.
Now, Karen, what did you think, without giving away the ending, because there may be somebody who's listening who hasn't seen it yet, What did you
That's
think?
Tough.
Too bad for them
tough
then. And then everybody died. I liked it. On the whole, I like the overall message that it gives. But if I had to explain
let go and
to
move
somebody,
on. Yeah, you got to forgive yourself and move on. Yeah, it's sort of very Buddhist.
Well, that wasn't really it. And it was more than that. It was about you have to forgive yourself and move on. The idea that there are certain people who come in and out of your life and that make you a better person because of being in your life. I found all of that really kind of interesting and moving. But if I had to explain to somebody what actually happened, I couldn't.
Have you been watching it consistently or did you just jump into the finale?
No, I've been watching it consistently since.
Oh, really?
The very
oh,
first
okay.
episode. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge Lostie. Huge.
Well, as Michael mentioned, 13.5 million viewers, plus the 100 million that will watch it on TiVo, to make me correct. it scored a 5.6, 5.7 rating. It was the highest.
But don't forget, too, the amount of people that are going to buy this when it comes out on DVD just for the extras.
Yeah, that's true. It should be noted that Jimmy Kimmel Live, which I guess aired right after it, right after the Lost episode, saw a huge rating increase to 3.2 million viewers, up from his average of 1.66.
I think the local news was on first.
Ah, okay.
I watched those too. I watched the alternate endings, which I have to say was pretty entertaining stuff. Very clever.
Well, if you missed out on Lost, or like me, are 10 episodes behind, then maybe Google is arriving just in time to help you. Google is getting into television. And Karen, if you could please explain to us what the heck is going on here and what Google TV is, I would personally appreciate it.
Okay, well, let's see if I can nutshell this, since we're making nutshell a verb today. Essentially what it is that it's Google on your TV. So you can, you have, you know, a keyboard and you're watching TV and you can search for what you're looking for, whether it's an actual TV show or YouTube, and, you know, whether you want to go online and watch a video or whether you want to search like for cable shows and watch a show or broadcast and watch a show, and then you can save them as favorites. I mean, that's essentially it, right? I mean, that's what I got out of it.
So they're making TV searchable.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And I guess they're doing it through, you know, software that's embedded into the television sets, like
software and hardware.
Right. They have this set-top box, and people have tried this whole set-top box thing before. Roku, Vudu, TiVo, Boxy, you know, those are all, and even Apple. Apple has Apple TV, and none of them have been overly successful. So I'm wondering why Google thinks they will be a success here, but certainly making TV searchable sounds good.
I think because Google is taking over the world, and frankly, I think that if anybody can do this, it's probably Google, although if you look at how they tried to mimic Twitter, they were not very successful. Google tends to do kind of better
nobody wants to sit at their television 10 feet away and surf the web. It's just nobody wants to do it.
But this is for more than just that. Like, this is for more and more people are watching TV on their computers. So this way, people can watch TV that they normally watch on their computer. They can watch it on their TV. In that respect, I think
so. It's just a way to get it from the computer to the TV. I mean, that's a different issue. So that's not set-top box. That's something attached to your computer to stream it to your television.
It's the internet. People want whatever they're watching on their computer, they're accessing from the internet. And you can access the internet with Google TV.
Blah, blah, blah. Nobody's been able to do it. It's a pain in the ass, Apple TV. It won't work.
Well, and that's why it's not going to work. Because I think it's ahead of its time. I still think it's very much ahead of its time. And I think that a lot of people watch TV on their computers because they're in their bedrooms or, you know, or someplace where they might not have a TV.
They're actually at work watching television, catching up on Lost.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
Or they're teenagers who don't have TVs in their bedroom.
Cable companies have just got to love this. They've got to be so excited.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious to know how that's going to work. But you know what? But cable companies are going to have to figure it out anyway, because there will come a time in the not too distant future that we are all going to be watching TV via the internet.
Yeah, true. I mean, IPTV, that's what it's all about. You know, I heard a bunch of analysts, you know, I read a bunch of news stories where analysts were questioning how Apple would respond to this. And it could be kind of exciting to see a little bit of competition here ratchet up the products that we're getting out of them. But really, I'm just waiting for Google to stream ads into my dreams and make my dreams searchable. Because when they get Google Dreams, that's what I want.
Did you know that there is there's an iPhone app that measures your sleeping?
Yes.
And you put it on the bed and it can tell by how you're tossing and turning whether you're in like deep sleep or light sleep.
Well, that is a sure sign that it is time to move on to our next segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they're a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. Our first story is about newspapers, which, despite everybody's prediction of their demise, continue to grow online. Unique visitors of the top 25 markets grew 10% from March to April, reaching 83.7 million people. In the top 10 markets, it rose 13% to 70.8 million unique visitors. Page views are up as well. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, to me, I think it's a big whoop because this doesn't really surprise me, although I have a feeling that a lot of other people think this is a big deal, but people are getting their news from somewhere. And they get it from their friends, but somebody gets it from the quote-unquote source. Got to have your source.
Michael, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a big deal for smaller markets because they're trying to pretend that newspapers are all bringing an audience. But in fact, what they're telling you is that everybody's flocking to the top 10, you know, newspapers, basically. The top 10 markets are the ones. People go to the LA Times and the New York Times and the Washington Post. They don't go to their paper in Arizona, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Arkansas, Seattle, you know. The mid-size and smaller newspapers are getting killed. They're losing subscribers, and they have no presence online, as this shows.
Well, that's the digital dilemma, isn't it? That when people have access to all of this information, that it tends to snowball and certain brands get bigger and bigger. Most of the advertising that's online is sold through Yahoo, Google, AOL, etc. And so when you hear all of these advertising numbers, most of that is going to like five to ten different people. Our next story is about Iranian director Jafar Panahi, who was released from jail 2 days after the Cannes Film Festival, where protests highlighted his detention. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop because he's still stuck in Iran and facing trial and jail. So Christian Amanpour likes to say that Iran is the most democratic country in the Middle East. I'm like, sure, except for Israel. And big deal, because look who the comparison is. So, you know, he's out briefly. Obviously, they caved a little bit to international pressure, but he's still, you know, in a terrible, terrible situation.
Karen?
I agree. Did you say, Michael, it was a big deal or a big whoop? Because I'm agreeing with you, but I don't know exactly which one you decided on.
Big whoop.
It's a big deal for him. I agree with Michael, whichever one he said.
Now, why was he thrown in jail in the first place? We should kind of mention that.
Well, I mean, they won't say, all they will say is that it's not political. They won't actually specify what he's done against the state. All they will say, it's not political. He's there because he's done bad things. It's perfectly reasonable. We just won't tell you what it is, and it's not political. What he did publicly was—
But it had to do with an election, didn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. They had the election. It was a total travesty. People protested in the streets, and they were slaughtered by the government, killed, sometimes tortured to death in custody. And he went and visited the grave sites of people who were killed during the protests. That was a big problem. He also sided with the opposition after the election was thrown, and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was named, you know, the president, even though he lost. International community, you know, condemned the election as fraudulent, and he sided with the opposition that probably won the election, but was not allowed to be into power anyway. So, you know, he placed himself in jeopardy, and now they've thrown him in jail, and now he's out on bail, but he faces more jail time down the road.
Well, speaking of jail time and bail and
yes,
fighting
from
the law,
Jafar Panahi to Lindsay Lohan.
Yes, and Michael, as you know, this was kind of a story that we kind of had the inside lead on, although we couldn't really say anything about it, because staying with us in Cannes was Matthew Wilder, the director of Inferno, which has yet to be shot, which is going to star Lindsay Lohan, and she was in Cannes to help promote that film and raise money for that film. With Matthew.
It's a biopic about Linda Lovelace, the porn star turned born-again Christian activist.
Yeah, and, you know, at the time, Matthew was telling us that Lindsay Lohan had lost her passport, and when she got back to the States, it was, you know, she might get into some trouble. Well, turns out Lindsay Lohan may or may not have lost her passport in Cannes, but she's definitely getting some new jewelry. A judge has ordered Lohan to wear an alcohol monitoring bracelet and to get random weekly drug tests. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big deal.
Michael?
I mean, it's just another story about Lindsay Lohan. I mean, there was one a couple of days before this, too.
You said big deal, but you're confusing our— You made it sound like a big whoop.
Oh, sorry. Big whoop.
We may have to rebrand this. I'll say it's a big deal because it's fascinating to watch somebody sort of implode. She's got all her family, advisors, and friends around her. And people know that she's troubled, but they don't know what to do to help her. They're not willing to help her and risk their position with her. So it's sort of interesting to see somebody really sort of spiral. She's a talented actress, and it's a shame she can't get her act together, like, you know, Amy Winehouse.
Well, it would be interesting to hear her side of the story, Lindsay Lohan's side of the story, that is. Even to your point, Michael, Matthew Wilder was saying, you know, exactly what you're saying, that, you know, trying to reach out to her is difficult, whether you're her best friend or assistant or family or a director. It can be difficult because of who she is and the people that surround her on a regular basis. So
both of you have worked with a lot of people. Have either of you ever worked with someone you thought was out of control but couldn't help?
Courtney Love.
I've worked with so many. I can't even name names, but I've worked with people that it sickens you for them to watch them just toss their talent away.
But you probably didn't feel like you were prominent enough with them to have an effect. It wasn't like you were their family or a real advisor to them, right?
Yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. Usually for me, if they were paying me, that was good enough and I really could care less. I mean, as awful as that sounds, it's like, it's very sad, but like ultimately like, oh yeah, it's sad. Did my paycheck clear? But I've definitely known people who have worked very closely with A-list stars who had a lot of sway over them too and did what they could to save them from themselves.
Well, hopefully we'll hear her side of the story sometime soon. Moving on to Paula Abdul, who is back on a talent show as a judge, and it's not Simon Cowell's The X Factor. CBS signed her to judge and play a major role on Got to Dance, a UK hit format in which people compete in every style of dance imaginable, and the judges serve as mentors a la The X Factor. Because you know what? We don't have enough dance shows on television. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's both. It's a big whoop. It's a big deal because it's such a big whoop. She should have gone on the X Factor. We don't need another dance show.
Michael?
I think it's a big deal as far as her saying, I want to succeed and prove everybody wrong on my own terms with my own show. She's like going to have a producing credit on the show. She's going to be involved behind the scenes. She's like, I'm not a dumb biddy. I want to have my own payday where I'm not just back with Simon serving as the, you know, trophy wife sort of silly sidekick. She's rolling the dice. I'm sure she could have been on the X Factor. She's rolling the dice and saying, I want my own unqualified success.
Did you watch her reality show?
Well, the reality show. No, I didn't watch that. Life is too short.
But she's a crazy person. And yes, please sue me. I don't think she can do this alone. I think she only does well as the sidekick. So I'd be very curious to see if this really works.
Well, we will surely find out. And speaking of dumb biddies and sidekicks, I mean, our next subject.
Ouch!
Of course, when I actually read the headline, everybody will know what I'm talking about. Megan Fox dissed Michael Bay's on-set behavior during interviews. Now she's been dumped from Transformers 3. Heidi Montag tweeted that she is totally available and loves Michael Bay. Does this mean Shia LaBeouf might not be in Indy 5? Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a complete big whoop. So it's interesting that people are pitching themselves to directors via Twitter.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. Karen?
They've already hired Gemma Atherton, so it's kind of a big whoop.
Is that official?
I don't think it's been made official in the trades or anything yet. But this is a huge deal for Megan Fox because, sweetheart, what are you thinking?
Well, she's trying to prove she's not
What is she thinking?
Yeah, she's an idiot.
Well, she was thinking that she was a little upset that Michael Bay was concerned over her weight. Apparently, she lost a lot of weight, and that was, you know, she decided to quit, apparently. And so,
sweetie, he didn't call you fat.
Well, it's a she said thing, and people are saying she was fired. She's saying she quit. Bottom line is, she's not in Transformers 3. Heidi Montag probably won't be either.
Yeah, nice try, honey. Nice try.
Our next story is about Bret Michaels, who we talked about a couple of weeks ago, who was in the hospital for a brain hemorrhage. He's back in the hospital. Now he's got a hole in his heart and has suffered a quote-unquote warning stroke. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I mean, it's a big deal for the obvious reasons.
Michael?
He's turning into our generation's Elizabeth Taylor, where his medical travails are more important than anything he does elsewhere. So it's
still
a big whoop.
Don't you think it's weird?
I mean, I've got to be honest with you. I wouldn't have recognized this guy from, you know, a serial killer.
What?
Or, you know, I
are you serious?
Yeah, I'm not a big, you know, heavy metal fan, so I never would have recognized
this
guy.
But how could you have been a teenager in the 80s and not know who Bret Michaels is?
I know who he is, but I could never recognize him. Now he's on TV and winning Celebrity Apprentice, and he's on People Magazine, and he is more popular sick and in the hospital than he ever was as the lead singer of a heavy metal band.
He did pretty well on Rock of Love.
Yeah, that's true. Well, our next story is about ABC's Nightline, which has held up surprisingly well after Ted Koppel left. But their journalistic standards have slipped just a tad. Jesse James, the estranged husband of Sandra Bullock, and I guess he's also a reality TV star, will be appearing on the show Tuesday night, the night we're recording this podcast. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for Nightline because it's just sad for them to chase this sort of interview. It's just destroys, I mean, any credibility they had. It's ridiculous.
Karen?
I completely disagree. I think this is a major story.
a major story, and, or do you mean like
this is a major story?
I agree, but he should be on Good Morning America. He shouldn't be on This Week with George Stephanopoulos or whatever. It's not the right venue. It's bad for him. It's bad for them. It's bad all around. He should be on Oprah or Good Morning America, something like that.
Well, but that's probably pretty smart on his part. You know, go on a late night show. I mean, kind of test the waters first. But it's been teased on like Good Morning America all week.
Well, and it just goes to show you how the media has changed, and how the ability to get viewers is not as easy as it used to be, and how you need to get these kind of salacious stories to attract viewers.
But but whether it's salacious or not is almost not the question anymore. It is a huge story. Whether we think it should be or not, it is. And this is a huge deal for Nightline, which has done phenomenally well. And it's a big deal.
Well, and what Jesse James will be talking about is the fact that he cheated on Sandra Bullock, and this all came out a week after she won her Oscar. And, you know, he said, I knew it was horrible the whole time, and I guess I wanted to get caught. Because I was
He's got that funny voice. It's like, I know it was bad, and I really wanted to get caught. And you're like, whoa, what? You ever heard him talk? He's got a really strange voice.
Well, moving on to our next story, CBS is changing the name of its upcoming William Shatner sitcom, Blank My Dad Says, to.
No, you got to say it, or it doesn't work, dude.
Yeah. I can't, because this is a family podcast.
Well, we can warn them that in the next 90 seconds, there will be expletives.
So, okay, the show used to be called My Dad Says, and now it's S number sign asterisk exclamation point My Dad
Says.
Like
Bleep My Dad Says, bleep, basically, yeah.
Bleep My Dad Says.
Wait, that's really stupid.
And the right-wing Parents Television Conference still condemn them for it. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Karen?
Yeah, it's a big fucking deal. Fuck, man.
I agree with you, Karen. They should have named it what it was. It's a tweet. It's an incredibly popular Twitter thing. My dad says they should have just gone for it.
No, really? Okay, I totally agree that they cannot call it My Dad Says. But to call it, like, Bleep My Dad? I mean, how are we supposed to tell our people we're watching?
Stuff My Dad Says.
Stuff My Dad Says was their working title. They should have just made it that. And I'm not a prude, but I think that was the way to go.
Well, I just really appreciate the fact that you were thinking about the time it would take to edit this particular week's episode when you were discussing this last news story. So I will move on immediately to U2, who is not moving on at all. They are postponing their tour, the latest American leg, at least, of its current tour, while Bono undergoes back surgery, emergency back surgery, in fact. It's not easy to rock and roll when you're 50. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for, you know, the obvious reasons that it sucks for Bono, but ultimately it's a big whoop.
Michael?
it's a big whoop, you know.
Well, here's why I think it's kind of a big deal. They were scheduled to play the Glastonbury Festival at the end of June, and let me tell you, booking an act like U2 for a festival like that is a huge get, and it's a huge deal, and they can't play it now. They even wrote a song just for the festival, just to play the festival. They say on their website they're really disappointed that they can't play it, and I'm sure the festival, you know, who are they going to get to replace them? Who knows? We'll keep an eye on that.
Well, they're the biggest act in the world, but Glastonbury gets lots of big acts, don't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they'll get somebody to fill in, but it's not going to be U2, that's for sure.
Could they have somebody step in for Bono?
That would be funny.
Where's Sammy Hagar?
Hey, Adam Lambert.
You know, maybe Brett Michaels will be out of the hospital in time.
No, he's going to be busy doing something for Trump.
Good point. That brings us to our final segment of this week's episode, Inside Baseball, where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And this week is kind of one of those stories. Disney is formally calling off talks with the Weinsteins, and that's Bob and Harvey Weinstein, who used to own Miramax, started it in 1979, sold it to Disney in 1993 for $80 million, then got kicked out, I guess it was in 2004, 2005 at some point, started the Weinstein Company, which is in a little bit of financial trouble, and Disney put the indie label up for sale earlier this year, was hoping to get $700 million. And the Weinsteins made an offer of $625 million, And they'd been backed primarily by billionaire Ron Burkle. And people familiar with the matter said the complex structure of the acquisition was the primary reason for why the talks fell apart. Again, I've got to cite the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times here for breaking these stories.
Well, I think this is really interesting because I also heard that, or I read that Ron Burkle was not going to give the Weinsteins equity. If he bought it, he was not going to give the Weinsteins equity. He was only going to make them asset managers. So they would essentially be employees because he didn't want, if anything should have happened, he didn't want anybody to be able to come after the company for it, the money that the movies make.
Oh, like suing him for like net profits or something?
Yeah, he didn't want the Weinsteins to have really any kind of a legal foothold here.
Yeah, that's iffy because there are legal ways to protect yourself from lawsuits like that.
It's just another twist in the saga of the Weinstein brothers. It would have been nice to see them get the Miramax name back, but ultimately it's just a label. It doesn't really matter.
Well, yeah, and we all expected that if there was going to be a deal, we would hear about it while we were in Cannes. That would be the appropriate place to announce something like that. And it turns out that last Friday the deal started to fall apart, and Disney kind of either officially or through back channels let it be known that they were moving on. And it's kind of important that that announcement is made either publicly or privately because they were in an exclusive negotiating period, so they couldn't actually take other bids or talk with other potential investors or buyers because they were dealing exclusively with the Weinsteins. So by kind of walking away from them, that exclusive period ends.
Well, so interesting because Disney kind of held all the cards here, didn't they? Not only did they own Miramax, but it was something that they figured that the Weinstein brothers would want just for personal reasons. So they, you know, whenever you're in a position where Disney owns, you know, has all the cards, things can only end badly.
Well, we'll see who winds up buying it. Odds are that the Goras, the wealthy investors whose brother Sam controls the Paradigm Talent Agency, and the wealthy brothers are Tom and Alec, they are making a play for, what is it, Overture Films they're trying to purchase. And they are also put in a bid for Miramax. We'll see if they follow through on it. But
so they're basically just buying the library, right?
Pretty much, yeah. They're buying the library and the right to use the name.
Yeah, that would be fascinating, wouldn't it?
Would be interesting.
I don't know why I find that fascinating, but it's like the Gores are like they're like totally inside baseball. It's like you have to work here to understand how important these people are.
Yeah, very true. I mean, they're very understated. You don't hear a lot about them. I'm sure if they buy Miramax, you'll hear a lot more about them.
I think they're basically a venture capitalist group.
Yes,
right?
They are. That is correct. Yeah, they're investors.
Do you think maybe the Gores would like to invest in a podcast?
Well, you know what? I will find out. I'll call them right now. And in the meantime, if you want links to any of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, you can visit our website and look up the show notes for episode 55. Our website can be found at showbizsandbox.com. Our website is where you'll find ways to contact us. You can do so via email. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And I guess, speaking of email addresses, I should thank Aaron Rich for pointing out the Wall Street Journal story about ticket prices. So thank you very much, Aaron. And you can also call us. 888-567-SAND is the number to call, and you can leave us a voicemail. Again, that number is 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our episodes is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group, whose song, as Michael pointed out last week, is played over the end credits of Inside Job, the Charles Ferguson documentary. They can be found on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Karen can be found on her website, karenwoodwardonline.com, or on Twitter, @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. Michael Giltz is on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. All of his writing, especially this stuff from Cannes, can be found on MichaelGiltz.com. And some of my work can be found, as always, on CelluloidJunkie.com. But this week, there are two video posts from Cannes on The Hollywood Reporter, one of Terry Fromeau and one of Charles Ferguson from Inside Job. I can also be found on Twitter. @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.